Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for February 7th. 1 week to go in the 25-day honeymoon for President Barack Obama that I mentioned last time. That's it. By next weekend, it'll be 25 days into a presidency, and it's already sink or swim time. 1 more week to button up a stimulus package, get it through conference between the House and Senate, and on Obama's desk for signature. 1 more week for Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner to sell his new financial recovery plan to be unveiled on Monday. President Obama will hold a primetime press conference on Monday evening as well. Another first test for our new leader. With so much to talk about, and what to that point will be all of 20 days. The world sits on the precipice of outright depression. And while in some matters nothing but time will heal our wounds, it is also a period that is crying out for global leadership, and Obama must answer the call. The IMF's Dominique Strauss-Kahn said on Saturday in Malaysia that advanced economies are already in a depression and the financial crisis may worsen unless the banking system is fixed. The worst cannot be ruled out, he said. There's a lot of downside risk. PIMCO's Bill Gross said earlier in the week the government must spend trillions to avoid a, quote, mini-depression. There is a potential catastrophe if the U.S. government continues to focus on billions of dollars, said Gross. General Electric CEO Jeff Immelt warned, quote, unlike the other downturns that I've been a part of, once you break through 74, 75, you don't stop till you get to 1929. The bleak nature of the financial news around the world continued unabated. Germany announced industrial production in December declined 4.6%, the worst single-month performance since reunification in 1990. Corporate bankruptcies in the UK soared 51% in the fourth quarter over year-ago levels. South Korea's exports for January plunged 33%. Japanese stalwarts Panasonic and Hitachi are facing losses of $3.9 billion and $7.8 billion, respectively, for their fiscal year. Even when the market saw a shred of good news, a better-than-expected reading for China's Purchasing Managers Index for January, it was still a contraction. The IMF cut its growth forecast for China to 6.7% in 2009, well below the magic 8% level we've all become so familiar with. While for the rest of Asia, the IMF is looking for growth of just 2.7%, down from a previous forecast of 4.9% just last November. And disconcertingly, labor unrest, be it in Russia, France, Britain, or China, continues to percolate, one step removed from spilling over into something far more flammable. Then you have the jobs picture in the United States. Friday's release of January employment saw non-farm payrolls decline a whopping 598,000, the most since January 1974. The stock market didn't bottom until December that year, I can't help but add. And the unemployment rate rose to 7.6%, the highest reading since late 1992. As PIMCO's Mohammed El Arian pointed out, the one-year rise in this figure from 4.9 to 7.6% is extraordinary and highly worrisome. Manufacturing lost 207,000 jobs and construction 111,000, once again leading the way. Since December of 2007, 3.6 million have lost their jobs in America. Aside from the jobs picture, December factory orders fell a greater than expected 3.9%. Personal income was down 0.2%. Personal consumption off 0.9%. Credit card delinquencies hit a record 3.75%. And consumer credit for the latest reporting period, November, fell by a record $11 billion, the biggest drop in this category since records began in 1943. With the jobs picture as bleak as it is, the consumption figures are hardly a surprise. But the ISM numbers for January manufacturing in the service sector were both a little better than expected, and December pending home sales rose 6%, though the latter continues to be influenced by sales of foreclosed properties. All of the above makes for enough of a combustible brew, but then you have this protectionism angle. that was oh so predictable, though at the same time it is still hoped cooler heads will prevail, whether it is the U.S. Congress, the Russian Duma, or the Chinese Communist Party. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown warned of the implicit protectionism he saw creeping through the debate, while the World Trade Organization is scrambling to keep up with new tariffs being levied from all quarters. Barron's Thomas Donlan reminds us of the lessons we should have learned from the past in looking back to a major cause of the Great Depression. Donlan writes, "Without a doubt, the Smoot-Hawley tariff worked. Imports fell 66% between 1929 and 1933, while exports declined 61%. Gross domestic product fell 50%, with the trade decline partly cause and partly effect. Only a madman would want this, but fear made many madmen in those days." By 1933, it was a breeze for Congress to enact a Buy American law, Donlan adds, which established preferences for U.S. goods and services in any government project. Lest we think that the days of Mad Men are past, important vestiges of the Buy American Act have never been repealed. And the House of Representatives last week added more weight to the nationalistic chains that rattle behind us and drag down the economy. So that brings us to the $800 billion-plus stimulus program that will be hashed out in conference this coming week after the Senate appears to have reached a compromise, and we wait to see how it may or may not contribute to the global protectionist debate. President Obama had the following in a Washington Post op-ed. "What Americans expect from Washington is action that matches the urgency they feel in their daily lives. Action that's swift, bold, and wise enough for us to climb out of this crisis. Because each day we wait to begin the work of turning our economy around, more people lose their jobs, their savings, and their homes. And if nothing is done, this recession might linger for years. Our economy will lose 5 million more jobs. Unemployment will approach double figures. Our nation will sink deeper into a crisis that at some point we may not be able to reverse. That's why I feel such a sense of urgency about the recovery plan before Congress. With it, we will create or save more than 3 million jobs over the next 2 years, provide immediate tax relief to 95% of American workers, ignite spending by businesses and consumers alike, and take steps to strengthen our country for years to come." That was President Obama. An editorial in the Washington Post offered, "Ideology is not the only reason that senators from both parties are balking at the president's plan. As it emerged from the House, it suffered from a confusion of objectives. Mr. Obama praised the package as not merely a prescription for short-term spending, but a strategy for long-term economic growth in areas like renewable energy and healthcare and education. This is precisely the problem. As credible experts, including some Democrats, have pointed out, much of this long-term spending either won't stimulate the economy now, is of questionable merit, or both. Even potentially meritorious items, such as $2.1 billion for Head Start or billions more to computerize medical records, do not belong in legislation whose reason for being is to give U.S. economic growth a jolt, as Mr. Obama himself has put it." Republican Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma said the following in an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, "One of the more egregious provisions in the Senate bill is a $166 billion bailout plan for the states that rewards bad budgeting at the state level. Simply sending cash to states without asking for appropriate sacrifices is grossly irresponsible. States will no longer have the incentive to live within their means because they'll assume the federal government will be there to bail them out." Representing the other side of the political aisle, economist Paul Krugman of the New York Times wrote, "The American economy is on the edge of catastrophe, and much of the Republican Party is trying to push it over the edge. Personally, I've just been sitting back, letting things sort themselves out as part of my wait 24 hours mantra before unloading one way or the other. I'm giving President Obama the benefit of the doubt for at least one more week, but that could be it. It's really quite simple. He can prove he's the pragmatic leader we need for these times and stand up to Democratic leaders Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, who are hardly pragmatists in their own right, while seeking compromise with moderates on the Republican side to forge a consensus the majority in this country can agree on. recognizing none of us can get everything we want, or Obama caves to Pelosi and Reid, ignores the Republicans' better intentions, and thus sets the stage for four more years of the same at a time when the nation and the world can ill afford it, nor will the people stand for it. Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi do not represent the views of the majority of Americans, the 65% to 70% that are generally moderate and straight down the middle on a broad spectrum of issues facing this nation. Yet President Obama thus far has been all over the map, and is here I'm forced to bring up his change theme, that he would end Washington business as usual. On one hand, he made a lot of good selections for his cabinet, but on the other, he received either very bad information from his transition team on folks like Bill Richardson, Timothy Geithner, and Tom Daschle, and or the nominees themselves didn't come clean during the initial vetting process. I screwed up, Obama was forced to tell five network anchors that interviewed him the other day after Daschle proved to be a supreme embarrassment. So much so the editorial board of the New York Times, not the president, forced the former senator to withdraw from consideration for the post of Secretary of HHS. It's important for the administration to send a message that there aren't two sets of rules, one for prominent people and one for ordinary folks who have to pay their taxes, Obama said. This is a self-induced injury that I'm angry about, and we're going to make sure we get it fixed. Well, we're living in a time where you can't help but dissect each day, and it's the same situation around the world. Ordinarily, a new president gets a pass for his early mistakes, a true 100-day honeymoon, as tradition would have it, but not now, as unfair as that may be. Stocks finally broke through, with the major averages rising for the first week in five this year, sloughing off the dire economic news and uncertainty in the halls of Congress and at the Treasury Department. Cisco Systems, a tech bellwether, announced that its current quarter revenues would decline 15% to 20%, yet the stock finished up. Bank of America was hit by rumors all week that it would be nationalized and common shareholders thus eviscerated. But it rallied smartly as CEO Ken Lewis said it would require no further government assistance. Disney reported disappointing earnings, yet it rallied back some by Friday's close. And while retail chain store sales figures for January were miserable, save Walmart's 2% increase, retailers also did well for the most part. For the week, the Dow Jones gained 3.5% to close at 8280. The S&P 500 advanced 5.2%, and NASDAQ surged 7.8% to 1591. NASDAQ is already back in the black for the year, up almost 1%. So was it short covering? Excitement over the stimulus package? Confidence a real bank rescue plan is in the offing? Probably a little of all three. We just have to see what kind of follow-through, if any, there is during this coming tumultuous week. I'll be back with you next Saturday and catch more information on my week in review link at stocksandnews.com.